And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Hilda from Pasadena.
My name's Hilda. I'm an alcoholic.
I
really want to thank Terry for asking me, Martina for looking after me, and Richard for doing such a great job. There's nothing better than having a strong 10-minute speaker. All the pressure just comes off. You've already heard the message, so I'm just going to waffle on, you know. I also want to thank Julie for coming down with me and a couple of the women I sponsor and some friends of mine from L.A. I just think that's brilliant, you know. I really do. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know there's a few of you here tonight, your attention span may be a little bit short, so I know mine was. If you hear nothing else, I just hope you know that if a lying bedwetting whore like me can get sober and stay sober, it'll work for anybody. So I was born in London. I grew up in a pub. I really did. My grandparents owned the pub, and I'm an only child and an only grandchild. And, you know, only children are really good at entertaining themselves, and I'm one of those. And from a young age, I loved alcohol. Loved everything about it. I loved the shape of the bottles, the colors of it, everything. I always share this because it just really sums up my alcoholism. And Richard was asking the question of when are you an alcoholic? And, you know, it talks about crossing the line. You know, the literature talks about crossing the line. And, you know, I really don't know when I crossed the line, but if there is an invisible line, I'm guessing I probably crossed it coming out of the womb. You know, because I had that thing about alcohol. And, you know, when I was little, my playground was the cellar where all the bottles were. And, you know, I would line up the whiskey bottles on one side and the vodka bottles on the other. And I'd have the whiskey bottles chatting to the vodka bottles. And they'd be chatting to me and I'd be chatting to them. And, you know, I loved it. And the sad part is in my 20s, they were still doing that with me, you know. Our literature sums me up lovely when it talks about, you know, it really doesn't matter how much you drink or how often you drink, it's what happens when you drink, and that many who are only potential alcoholics become the real thing in a short amount of time, particularly women. And I am one of those women, you know. Whenever I read that, I think, yeah, okay, I get that. You know, at 16, I had an ulcer. At 17, I got done for drunk driving. At 18, I had a heart attack. And 6 months later, I was in my first mental hospital. And that's really when drink was working. You know, it all went downhill after that, you know. I was in 5 mental hospitals. The last one was the Institute for the Living in Hartford, Connecticut. And, you know, when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have sworn that was my only mental hospital. I was about 2 years sober, and I requested my records, my medical records. I would not recommend that to anyone because it's about this thick, and I am really unwell, you know. But I found out I'd been in 4 other mental hospitals. But when I went into the Institute for the Living, I had been in my own flat for 2 weeks. I had the curtains drawn, the answering machine on, 56 channels of nothing on the telly. Hadn't spoken or seen anybody for 2 weeks, and I had never been happier. Never been happier. There are days today when I think that was probably one of the greatest moments of my life. You know, I had a fridge full of Asti Spumante, Michelob Light, and vodka. And, you know, I have a clear memory of standing in the shower, drinking a cold Mick Light, not knowing if it was day or night, not caring, and just thinking it doesn't get any better than this. You know, I mean, that's the sort of drunk I am. And And what happened was I got a little knock on the door, and when I answered it, my mom was there, my shrink, two policemen, and two nurses, and a very legal-looking piece of paper. And they shot me in the arse with something and wrapped me in a jacket with really long arms. And I came to in the Institute for the Living in Hartford, Connecticut. And, you know, I really thought I was on candid camera or something. You know, I thought any minute now somebody's going to jump out and go, gotcha. You know, they never did. What I found out was that I had been committed for being a danger to myself and others. And the baffling thing for me was that I hadn't seen anybody for 2 weeks. You know, I got the suicidal because, you know, I mean, I was always suicidal. I really believed if you knew me like I knew me, you'd want to kill me too, you know. But I didn't get who the others were. You know, it was really, I probably spent the first 3 or 4 months in the Institute trying to figure that out, you know. And, you know, anybody who's been in a mental hospital will tell you that the people who are in there with you are really unwell. You know, I knew there was something wrong with me, and I knew they didn't know what it was. Because I don't believe I've ever been the full ticket. I don't think I ever will be the full ticket, and I don't think there's a program in the world that will make me the full ticket. What I do believe is that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous gives me the tools that allows me to act as if I'm the full ticket, right? But when I was in the Institute, I had this roommate who really was crazy. And she had these things like rage attacks. You know, she'd be fine 1 minute, and the next minute she'd be punching out windows and going for nurses, and it was just crazy. And they would come in, and they did this thing called wet packing. And they would take these cold, wet sheets, and they'd all tackle her, wrap her up in these sheets, and toddle her away. You know, now she had something I didn't have, and that was friends locally. And she had money hidden all over our room. You know, and every time she got toddled away, I would start thinking, right? It's kind of a waste, all that money just hanging about. You know, somebody should do something with it, you know. And she was always gone for a while, so, you know. So I used to go AWOL on her dime. And I was always going back because I'm in Hartford, Connecticut. I didn't even know where that was, you know. So I knew I was going back, but I would go AWOL, and I went AWOL this one time with $50, and I'm in downtown Hartford, and this fella comes up to me and says, psst, do you want to buy a ticket to Prince? Now, I didn't know who Prince was. I'm an AC/DC Black Sabbath kind of girl. But I'm thinking, you know, a dark auditorium, this might be good, you know. So I got these tickets. I smuggle in 2 bottles of vodka, and I'm sitting in the nosebleed seats while Prince does his little raspberry beret thing. And I got pleasantly toasted, you know. And after the concert, I was wandering around Hartford, and I went into the park, and there were these winos sitting in a little circle passing a bottle. And I sat down with them, you know. And they kept looking at me like stupid or crazy. You know, but they were good as gold to me, and they let me drink with them. And as dawn was coming, the white van with the blue letters up the side, Institute for the Living, pulled up, you know, and I stood up and said to these fellas, you know, sorry, I got to go, my ride's here. You know? And true story. And, you know, these fellas just looked at each other like, yep, crazy. You know? And, you know, I was always in trouble and losing my little trust points and having to build them back up and, you know, the institutional stuff. And after my year was coming up, I should say, I had to go before a board of psychiatrists. And my psychiatrist stood up and said, Hilda will never live in normal society. She is completely incapable. And his recommendation was that I stay for a minimum of another year. And it took me 2 months to convince that board to let me out. So I was in for about 14 and a half months, something like that. And I got out, and I was living in Hamden, Connecticut, which is just down the road. And I got a job, and I met a fella, and he turned out to be a coke dealer. And I had never done coke. Now, the attractive thing to me was that when I did coke, I could drink more, which was really attractive. So I was working, and I had $700 a week in my paycheck, and I had a $1,500 a week habit. And if you do the math, it doesn't really come out terribly well. And what happened was I was on my counter in the kitchen one day, and I looked out and realized I had sold everything, including my curtains, for coke. And I was drinking a case of McLeod at the time because I was always watching calories. And I thought to myself, Hilda, if you're hanging out with people who will buy your curtains, we have a problem here. And you know, I never did coke again. Never touched it. In fact, anytime I was in a party or anything else and people were doing coke, my little head would go, no, remember the curtains? You know? And I really believe, you know, my head never once did that with alcohol. It never once said, don't drink, Hilda, remember such and such, remember the Institute, remember the drunk, never. My head would go, well, maybe we shouldn't drink red wine tonight because it makes us cry. You know, stay away from the whiskey because it makes you mean, you know. But it never said stay away, period, you know. And I believe that that's what makes me a real alcoholic, you know, because alcoholism lies to me. So I'm in Connecticut, and I get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I think I never should have left England. It was so much better there, you know, and I'd move back to England, and I wouldn't be there very long. And I'd get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I'd think, you know, America was so much better. You know, I don't know what I was thinking, you know. And I have a long list of arrests for indecent exposure, and I know I don't look the type, but I have a reaction to alcohol that I know a lot of women in Alcoholics Anonymous have. That as soon as you add alcohol to this alcoholic, I absolutely have to show you my tits. Now, I know that that's part of my alcoholism, because I don't feel the need to show them to you now. So I was back and forth, America, England, back and forth, back and forth, and, you know, it was always going to be different, and as Richard mentioned, the disease travels with me, and I ended up, I'm a blackout drinker, and if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't know what that means, I thought that when I lost time, I had passed out. What I found out was that that's not true. A friend of mine's birthday was on New Year's Eve, so we would always start drinking on Christmas Eve, as you do. And I came to on the 3rd of January in my flat, starkers naked, with the phone ringing. And when I answered the phone, my friend Andy was on the phone. Guy whose birthday it was, and Andy says to me, are you ready to pick out rings? And I didn't know what he was talking about. And he says, no, Hilda, not this time. Now, Andy brought over a video, and I'm on this video, and I look great. I have a drink in my hand the whole time. I am not slurring my words. I'm not walking funny. I look great. And I watched the video, and I wasn't there. And I'm watching him go down on one knee, and I stood there watching it going, say no. And that's when I realized that when I lost time did not mean that I had passed out, that I was fully functioning and that you had no idea that I was in a blackout. And I got a terrible fright, and I did what I did best, really. I went to the pub, and I started chatting to this fella in the pub and telling him my sorrows. You know, poor old me. I'm engaged again. I've been engaged 5 times, 4 rings. People always want to rescue me. I don't know. So I'm chatting to this guy in the pub, and he said, "Did you know, Hilda, that if you volunteer on a kibbutz in Israel, they give you 3 meals a day, they do your laundry, you know, and you get £50, I think it was, a month." I thought, result. 3 days later, I'm in Golders Green, I'm getting my visa, and I'm on my way to Israel. I'm a good Irish Catholic girl in a Jewish kibbutz. This made sense to me. You know, it was all going to be different. And I wasn't there very long. And I came out of blackout in jail, in a Tel Aviv jail, charged with drunk driving. And I didn't remember renting the car. And I can tell you that really horrible things happen to young, vulnerable women who drink like me in places like that. And I ended up jumping bail, and I was in Egypt. And I can tell you really horrible things happen to young, vulnerable women who drink like I do in places like that. And I ended up in a tattered T-shirt and a beat-up pair of shorts, a pair of loafers, left on the roundabout in front of the American Embassy. And a big Marine took mercy on me. Lovely fella. He let me sleep. It was Ramadan, and everything was closed, including the embassy. And he let me sleep in the quad of the embassy until it opened, and they got me an emergency passport. And, you know, I really believe that normal people on the flight home probably would have thought about never drinking again. But I'm an alcoholic, and I wasn't 10 minutes in the air, and I thought I was just unlucky. You know, I'm the type of alcoholic that when something bad happens, I just move the goalpost back a little bit more. You know, it was bad, but it could have been worse. And it gets worse, and I push it back just a little bit more and say, yeah, but they could have killed me. Just keep moving it back. That's the sort of alcoholic I am. And, you know, what happened was I did get back to England, and it was all the same stuff all over again. You know, done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I just didn't know how to stop it. You know, I just didn't know. And I ended up moving back to America, and I was living with my mom. And, you know, I started thinking about my uncle. And when I was 18, my uncle had tried to 12-step me in a pub in St. Albans. And I can remember him saying to me, "You know, Hilda, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you need never drink again." I was 18. I thought, why wouldn't I want to drink? I had no clue what he was talking about, you know. But, of course, he saw where I was going. And I thought about him, and the fact that he was still sober really affected me, because he was what I thought a real alcoholic was. I mean, my uncle went to prison. I only ever went to jail, you know. My uncle went to detox. I only ever went to mental hospitals, you know. So in my mind, he was always a worse alcoholic. And yet here he was, still sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I thought I would give it a go, and I toddled down to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on New Year's Eve, 1989. And it was in Papillion, Nebraska. And, yeah. And it was a small meeting, and it was New Year's Eve, and they were getting ready for some dance or something, and they were reading from the 24-hour-a-day book. "He's the father, we're the children." I thought I was screwed. I thought, if that's the answer, I am in deep trouble, you know, because I've always been a seeker. I mean, I went to Israel, please. You know, I thought, this can't be it, you know, and I could hear nothing else in the meeting, so I started taking everybody's inventory by their shoes, right, because I can't look at you. And next to me was this guy with these big, huge cowboy boots. And I kept thinking, I wonder if his IQ is any bigger than his boot size, you know, and started really taking him to pieces. And I had no clue what was going on. I went out to my car when it was over, and this big, dumb cowboy comes up to me and says, "Have you got a big book?" I said, "Of course I have a big book. Doesn't everybody have a big book?" Now, I wouldn't have known a big book if you'd have hit me with it. But I couldn't tell him that, you know. So I was speechless, because he went to his truck and he gave me his big book. And it was the first time anybody had seen straight through me. And as I was getting in my car, this little old woman ran up to me and said, "Did you know if you go to a lot of meetings and you don't drink in between, you can't get drunk?" I thought, thank you. in my car, I thought, oh, freaks, you know. But I tell you what happened was, as I drove away, that little woman's voice kept reverberating in my head. And I kept thinking, hang on a second, she might have something here. If I went to a lot of these meetings and I didn't drink in between, I might stay out of trouble, which was really attractive to me. And you know, that's exactly what I did. For about 3 years, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. My life got great quick. And I sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous saying, my name's Hilda and I'm an alcoholic. And a little voice in the back of my head would say, oh, my uncle thinks so. My mother thinks so. You know, my partner had thought so. But I kept thinking, you know, I'm glad you guys have the steps because you really need them. You know, I thought they were for people who were really unwell. And that wasn't me. You should be glad I'm here because you need me, you know. What happened was I suffered from arrogance and ignorance and I didn't know it. You know, I didn't know it. And the woman who was my sponsor got cancer when I was just over 3 years sober, and she was dying. And I went to see her in hospital one day, and she said to me, you know, Hilda, Alcoholics Anonymous will be here for you when you come back. And I hadn't drank yet. And, you know, I always remember that today because I know that shortly what followed when she died really sums up how dangerous it is to try and do Alcoholics Anonymous without the steps and without a higher power, because I had neither. And she passed away, and I went from 7 meetings to 5 to 4 to 3 to 2 a week, 2 a month, 1 a month, and now I'm in Florida. And I'm on my way to a job in Germany, my dream job, you know. And I'm in Florida, and my partner, who had come back because I wasn't drinking, we're walking on the beach one day, and my partner turns to me and says, you know what, Hilda, not only do I not like you, I don't love you drunk or sober. Sure. I thought, are you kidding me? 3.5 years, I haven't had a drink for you, which is really what it was all about, you know. So I dropped my now ex at the airport, and as the plane took off, I walked into the bar. I started with double Jack, because that's how I drink. Started drinking on the Thursday. I arrived in Germany on the Sunday. I started my new job on the Monday. I got done for drunk driving on the Friday and woke up in bed next to my new boss on Saturday morning. Glamour drinking. I drank like that for 9 months. And I can tell you that at the end of 9 months, on the morning after what I hope is my last night before, I woke up in my own bed, which had become a bonus. It was wet, which was normal. I was still dressed from work. And I went into the bathroom, and as I was washing my face, there was blood everywhere. And I looked in the mirror at a great gash down my face. My hose were all ripped. And I had no clue what had happened the night before. And I had that moment that I heard people in Alcoholics Anonymous share about, you know, the hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. You know, I always thought you were just dramatic. You know? That morning, I knew who they were. And I have to tell you, my heart broke when I realized I could no longer drink safely. I can drink. I could drink tonight. It's Saturday night. But I couldn't drink safely anymore. I didn't care when I was unpredictable to you. But when I became unpredictable to me, I got frightened, you know. And I did the only thing I knew what to do. I called out English-speaking AA. And I spoke to a fellow, Steve Baker, who does let me break his anonymity. And I called him up and I told him my sad old story. Poor old me. Been to Alcoholics Anonymous. Screwed it up. Wine, wine, wine. And, you know, he said something to me that I truly believe saved my life, because he said, you know, Hilda, in Alcoholics Anonymous, the most natural thing to do for an alcoholic is drink. That's what we do. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't shoot our wounded. And I believed him. I believed him. It's the only reason why I went to a meeting that night. And, you know, I was driving over to the meeting, and I suddenly had this thought. I didn't want anybody to think I didn't know what was going on in here, right? I could quote chapter 5, and I'm not talking about where it stops with God could and would if he was sought. I'm talking about chapter 5. I memorized the whole thing so that you would think I was pretty well, you know. So I'm going over to this meeting thinking I know what I'll do. The meetings in California and Florida were like this size, where I could slide in quietly and sit in the back. And I thought I would just start to get this by osmosis, you know. But the meeting was in Hunsbrook, Holland, and there were 7 people in the room. for an hour and a half's meeting. And they weren't letting me pass, you know. So I told him my sad old story. Poor old me. Binde, screwed it up. Wine, wine, wine. And, you know, after the meeting, they were looking for somebody to make the tea and coffee. And I was thinking, you know, I hope they find someone. You know. That's a really important commitment, you know. And this voice from across the room went, Hilda will do it. I thought, Hilda who? I mean, this meeting was Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and this was Tuesday night. I said to the woman, I don't know if I'm going to be sober on Thursday. That seemed like a long time to me. And she goes, well, if you want to stay sober, you'll make the tea and coffee. Now, my little head went, who is this psycho woman, and why is she tormenting me? But my mouth went, yeah, okay, I'll do it. Because I was done. I was out of ideas. I was tired. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really hope you're tired. You know, I would have done anything that woman suggested. And tried, actually. You know, she said to me, you really should try to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, do you see where we are? Honsbrook, Holland. It's like nowhere, take a left. She goes, yeah, I know, Hilda, but there's a meeting in Dusseldorf on Friday nights and Kaiserslautern on Wednesday and Dahan on Sunday. I looked at her. I said, I am not driving all over God's acre for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not happening. She went, well, how far did you drive for a drink? I was like, oh. Because I am one of those drunks driving at 2 in the morning looking for something open, you know. So I started driving all over for meetings. And every Thursday night I tormented my home group. I'd say, I'm going to Dusseldorf tomorrow night. Does anybody want to go? And the one guy I hated the most, hated, always went, I'll go with you, Hilda. It's like anybody but you, you know. And this guy had about 8 years of sobriety, Mike, and sure enough, every Friday he would ride with me and he'd play with the electric windows in my car. And you have to remember, I am a crazy newcomer, right? I was really crazy when I got sober. And I have left skid marks on the Autobahn where I've pulled over to tell him to get out, you know. And he would just laugh. He'd say, oh, I find it easier to drive when I don't drive everybody else's car. Just wanted to kill him, you know. And I tell you, one of the things I'm really grateful for is that I did get sober in such a small group where I did dislike, hate everybody. Because I learned principles before personalities really quick. You know, I had to. I needed these people. And sure enough, every Friday we would drive an hour and a half to Dusseldorf for an hour and a half's meeting, for an hour's coffee afterwards, and an hour and a half drive home. We did the same thing to Kaiserslautern. We did it to Dahan. Drove all over. And today I'm very grateful for that. You know, I fought and argued through the steps with my sponsor to the point that one day she threw the big book at me across the kitchen and said, you know, Hilda, when you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, just read the black bits. There is nothing in between the lines. What they say is what they mean. And I had such a hard time with that because I thought there must be a little bit more to it. You know, it needs to be a little bit more complicated, right? And, you know, I was about 9 months sober, and my company moved me to Belgium. They did not get the memo that said I wasn't supposed to have any major changes in the first year. And I ended up in Belgium, and I hated it. So much so that I was seriously contemplating shooting myself. I was doing duvet therapy. You know, where you get home from work, get under the duvet, get up the next day and hope it all changed. It doesn't work, but I stayed sober. I ended up calling my sponsor for a little bit of sympathy one day. I wouldn't recommend that. And I told her what was going on, and she said, you know, Hilda, you need to blow the dust off your big book and get your happy little arse 20 minutes up the road in Brussels, where they have a meeting 7 nights a week. And when you get there, I want you to share honestly. And I did that, and I went to the Brussels meeting, and when I went in, they had almost no literature, and their coffee was like sludge. And when I shared, I told them so. And, you know, an amazing thing happened to me, because afterwards, they gave me the literature commitment, and they took me to coffee. And I learned about putting my hand out again, you know. And they really saved my life in Belgium, and I'm Brussels, and I'm really grateful for that. And, you know, my first sponsor was like the service sponsor from hell. She volunteered me for everything, everywhere we went, you know. And I'm so grateful for that foundation. And it's still a huge part of my sobriety today. I wouldn't be sober without service, because when I moved from Belgium to London, I did it all different. I had a home group before I arrived. I had a service commitment ready for me when I moved there, and I was not suicidal in sobriety. And I learned about doing something different for a different result, you know. And I was in London about 2.5 years sober. I got a great idea to change my career that I had for 20 years. And I wouldn't recommend that either. And I ended up on the dole, and I started doing voluntary work, and I got into university when I was about 4 years sober. And at 4.5 years sober, I got my first tattoo and my first motorcycle, you know, because people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me I could do absolutely anything if I was willing to do the work and pay the price. And I believe that to be true, you know. I started my second year at university, which was a miracle to me, and not so much to you. And people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to think it was because people in AA believed in me. And I heard a speaker recently who had the same experience, and she described it as people in Alcoholics Anonymous having faith in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I get that now, you know. And I was about 5 years sober, and, you know, I got a bigger tattoo. And I had had a motorcycle accident, so I got a bigger bike, you know. And I was about 8 years, 6.5 years sober. And I got a call one day as I was leaving my flat. And we were on our way to a convention, and my mom was on the phone. And my mom said to me she had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And she asked if I would come home. And that in itself was a miracle, because in my family, nobody told me anything. Anytime I was told about bad news, I went on a bender and made him worry worse, you know. And here my mother was asking me to come back to California when she had her operation. And I said I would. And we went to this convention, and I wasn't going to tell anybody what was going on, you know. But an amazing thing in Alcoholics Anonymous is that my insides are starting to match my outsides, and I didn't know that. And people who had known me in Alcoholics Anonymous started to see that. And this guy pulled me over at the convention, and he said, "Would you share at the midnight meeting? There'll be nobody there. The old-timers meeting's going on at the same time." And I said, "You know, I really don't feel up for it." And he said, "You know, you look like you need to share." And I went into this meeting. There were 200 people there. And I shared about my mother. And for the first time in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, at 6.5 years sober, I cried. I had never cried in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, when you cried, I could tap your leg, you know, "Sorry, hope you feel better," you know. But I really had no frame of reference, you know. I had nothing. And it was the first time I cried when I shared about my mom. And, you know, a guy I barely knew stood up in the back of the room and offered me a flight home if I couldn't afford it. And something happened to me that night. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous touched me. And I realized for the first time that I was part of something bigger than a meeting, that I was part of a fellowship, and I was in the middle of the bed, you know. And my sobriety really hasn't been the same since. I did come home when my mom had her operations, and I was there when she woke up, and I was there when she went to bed. And oddly enough, Julie's friend always says, "Is that odd or is that God?" Because of what I had been doing at university, I got to bring her home early, and I got to nurse her at home. And, you know, I had asked my sponsor for years, how would I make amends to this woman, my mother? I'm an only child. I broke her heart over and over. I called her from foreign jails where she could do nothing. And my sponsor always said, "You know, Hilda, it's God's time, not yours. And when the time's right, you'll know." And I was nursing my mom one day in the bathroom and emptying her tubes. And she turned to me and said, "You know, Hilda, how will I ever repay you?" And I said, "You don't get it. 6.5 years I have waited for this moment when I get to be a daughter, when I get to be of service to my mother." You know, I love that phrase, "Life is not measured by the number of breaths we take, but by the moments that take our breath away." because that's my sobriety, those moments. It's not about the years, but those moments, you know, that have really made the difference. For my mother's 60th birthday, I got to take her back to Ireland, where she was born and raised. And when I was going, my sponsor and people in the meeting said, you know, be sure to make it about her. And took her to Ireland, and I got to see where she bought her sweets and where she caught the bus and where she went to school. And, you know, and any time I wanted to make it about me, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you reminded me that it was my mother's trip, you know, and I loved it. And we were in Wicklow, where my mom's from, and my mom turned to me and said, you know, you've really turned into a lovely young woman. My mom, you know. And a couple of years ago, I walked for my bachelor's degree, actually finishing something, which is a miracle in itself for me. But it was nice because that morning my partner had given me a card, and on it it said, congratulations of reclaiming one of those things at which alcoholism had taken. And I realized in that moment that, you know, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, strong sponsorship, and a higher power that I believes in me when I don't, those things are possible, you know. My father, who was my fixer, I was daddy's girl. My father died, he'd left me money, and, you know, my dad always had great hopes for me, and I never fulfilled them. And a couple of months ago, we were in Washington, D.C., and my father's buried in Arlington, and I had never been back there sober. You know, I buried him drunk, and I'd never been back, and we went back, and I found, I don't even know how I found it, but I found the family pass that had been given to me when I buried him, and we took the pass and went into Arlington, and, you know, we went over to his grave, and I stood at my dad's grave, and, you know, I was standing there alone, and I thought, he would be proud of me today. Not because I finished my bachelor's degree, or that I have a good job, or that I'm almost done with my master's degree. None of that. Or that I've even been of service to my mother. My father would be proud of me today because I walk with grace and dignity. Because the women in Alcoholics Anonymous have taught me how to do that. Because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've cleared my wreckage. You know, because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I try to be of service. Be of service, it talks about it in the big book. It says, to be of maximum service to God and our fellows. You know, my sponsor is an amazing woman. And, you know, it doesn't matter what I call her about. Her first question to me is, have you been of service today? You know, I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I came to you a lying, bedwetting whore, and somewhere along the way, you've turned me into a good friend, a loyal partner, and a true daughter to my mother. And for that, I thank you.